The CDC is investigating two cases in Iowa of something called acute flaccid myelitis. Today, more on this mystery illness that can paralyze children. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In a moment, I'll talk with the state epidemiologist, Dr. Caitlin Padotti. Then with Brian Morelli of the Gazette about the lingering financial headache in Cedar Rapids stemming from the Nubo Evolve Festival. In the second half hour, we'll explore a movement called Gender Responsive Corrections. It's the simple idea that prison rules created to control men, especially violent ones, often don't work well for women. I'll talk with Warden Cheryl Dahm and Deputy Warden Lori Woodard. That's all coming up. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A number of interesting topics today during the hour. A little bit later, Brian Morelli of the Gazette will be joining us to talk about the lingering financial headache in Cedar Rapids stemming from that Nubo Evolve Festival back in August. Then in the second half hour, we'll explore a movement called Gender Responsive Corrections. A really simple idea, actually, that prison rules created to control men, especially violent ones, often don't work well for women. I'll talk with Warden Cheryl Dahm and Deputy Warden Lori Woodard of the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women in Mitchellville. That coming up in our second half hour. But first, the Center for Disease Control, CDC, is investigating two cases in Iowa of something called acute flaccid myelitis. Let's talk a few minutes to learn about this mystery illness, an illness that can paralyze children. Dr. Caitlin Padotti is with us, the Iowa Department of Public Health Medical Director and State Epidemiologist. Dr. Padotti, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. Tell us about this disease. What is it?
Yeah, so as you said, acute flaccid myelitis, or AFM, it really means sudden onset of weakness in the arms or legs that's related to inflammation in the spinal cord. So that's what those three words roughly translate to. Now, AFM is not actually a new phenomenon. This was the same clinical picture that we saw decades and decades ago following infection with the polio virus. Now, none of these cases that have been happening nationwide have been associated with polio. But the idea that you have inflammation after a viral infection is sort of the same. Now, certainly that can be a very scary thing to hear, you know, for providers and parents alike. But one of the good things, thankfully, is that this is very rare, less than one in a million. You know, so quite a rare it appears to be a very rare complication of some viral infections, although unfortunately, we don't quite have a single etiology just yet. But that's one of the ways that I think, you know, public health can play a big role is by helping to work with our clinicians and with our, you know, our federal partners at the CDC to gather as much information as we can to get a little more understanding on this.
Is there a particular virus, or is it, it sounds like there's possibly more than one virus connected with acute flaccid myelitis?
Yeah, it's possible that it could be more than one virus. Historically, we've seen other types of viruses create this kind of inflammation. So, as I mentioned, long ago it was polio, which thankfully we don't see anymore because we have a great vaccine against polio. We've also seen cases from time to time associated with West Nile virus, although that doesn't seem to be what's explaining this increase.
Mm-hmm.
We've also seen cases associated with another class of viruses called enteroviruses. And what's interesting about those, you know, most of the time they just cause sort of a cold, runny nose type illness, and most people recover without any issues. But that is sort of the same family that polioviruses come from. And if you recall back in 2014, that's sort of the first time recently that we saw this resurgence of AFM. And that year there were about 120 cases across the nation. And around that same time, there seemed to be a coinciding increase in enterovirus infections. But unfortunately, we haven't yet been able to link every single case of AFM to enterovirus. So biologically, medically, it would appear that there are several viruses that can do this. But by working together with other states and with CDC, we're hoping that we might be able to understand why we seem to be seeing these periodic increases.
Dr. Caitlin Pedotti is with us, a state epidemiologist. What can you tell us about the two Iowa cases that were mentioned?
Yeah, I can share. You know, of course, whenever we have information, we protect our Iowans' information very carefully. But I can share with you that one of the cases occurred in western Iowa and one was in central Iowa. I can tell you that both of these were in children, so people under 18 years old. Neither of our cases died, and there's only been one death nationwide associated with this. And I can tell you that one of the cases reported to us was associated with an enterovirus infection, and there's still testing pending on the other.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us how the children are doing in terms of the paralysis? Is that long-term, short-term?
You know, I can't get into the details of the cases of either child. Mm-hmm. You know, and honestly, I wasn't the treating doc for either of them, so I would hate to sort of comment on that. But I can tell you, in general, it does appear that most people affected by this do recover, but there is some variation from person to person, depending on what sorts of support they need and for how long.
Mm-hmm. So the real questions here concerning acute flaccid myelitis, when we look at this, it sounds like sort of a mystery. What are the biggest questions that you see you and your colleagues tackling?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest questions we have in epidemiology and public health is trying to figure out if there's one single cause that could explain these increases that we've seen. I mentioned that back in 2014, there appeared to be a nationwide increase of about 120 cases. It seemed like that happened again in 2016. About 149 were reported to CDC. And it looks like it's happening again now, so about 62 nationwide is what CDC is reporting. And whenever we see these kinds of things, it makes us wonder if there's a single etiology, a single cause that could explain this sort of thing. And as I mentioned, one of the most important things that public health can do is work with our providers to increase awareness on this sort of thing, work with them to get the right samples and pieces of information together so that hopefully we can collaborate with other states and with CDC to see if we can figure out what might be going on here. But in the meantime, we certainly understand that something like this can make people pretty concerned. And again, I think one of the things we'd like to offer is a little bit of reassurance that this is thankfully pretty rare.
What do you mean by pretty rare?
Less than one in a million.
Less than one in a million. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, rare. But again, you know, certainly concerning. And any parent who's worried, any person who's worried about sudden onset of paralysis should certainly see their healthcare provider. But for people who are looking for things to do to improve their health overall, you should always be up to date on all of your vaccines, which includes the seasonal flu vaccine. Flu is, of course, much more common than AFM, and it's important that everybody 6 months and older gets their flu vaccine, which is just a good thing to do for preventive health in general. And sort of as simple as it sounds, you know, a lot of the messages we talk about in public health, so covering your cough, staying home when you're sick, those are really important things to do, and they'll protect you against a variety of illnesses.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of prevention of this, it would be hard with so many open questions to know how exactly to prevent even this rare disease, right? Just the same sort of things that we do with colds and flus, you know, wash your hands, right?
Correct. And, you know, as unsatisfying as I could imagine that is, those really are very important messages and very important things to do. You know, those simple things of washing your hands well, covering your cough, staying away from others when you're sick, they're good ways to keep things from spreading from one person to another, and they really do work.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about, as we're coming up on flu season, or has it already started?
Yeah, so we've been reporting the Iowa Department of Public Health, again, one of the things that it does is look for patterns or activity of different illnesses, and flu is one of them. So we issue a flu report every week, and we're at what we would call a sporadic level. So we're seeing a couple of positive flu tests here and there, but it's still pretty low level. This would be a great time for everybody to go out and make sure that they're getting their seasonal flu vaccine so that when the activity does increase, they'll have that immunity in place, which takes about 2 to 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And the immunity lasts typically how long?
That's a great question. You know, there's been a lot of research into trying to find the quote-unquote sweet spot for a flu vaccine. And there's been some research that shows, you know, for different people, the immunity probably decreases over time. There's not been any good research to show one particular time during the season is the best time. The idea here is you want to get the shot about 2 to 4 weeks before you could be exposed, mm-hmm. because you want to give your body that time to practice. So given that we are coming up on sort of a holiday time when there's a lot of people around each other and it's easier for things to move from person to person, this is probably right around that good sweet spot for getting your vaccine. And in fact, the CDC recommends that everybody 6 months and older does that before the end of October.
Right. And we know the vast majority of people, when they get the flu vaccine, have maybe a little bit of soreness in their arm, massage it away, maybe take a 24 hours or something like that. Are there other reactions that are more severe than just a little bit of muscle soreness?
No. Very rarely there are some people who are truly allergic to the vaccine or a component of it. That's thankfully very, very rare. Other than that, you know, like you said, most people will probably get a little bit of soreness. They might feel a little bit of, you know, bit tired, and they may even have a very mild increase in temperature. All of those things are normal, and they're actually things that tell you that your immune system is doing what it should. It's practicing and learning how to fight this. You do not get influenza from the flu shot. And another thing that's important to know is, even if the flu shot isn't a perfect match for the virus that you experience, it probably teaches your immune system how to fight it a little bit better than it would have if you hadn't been vaccinated at all.
Mm-hmm. So when we get the flu vaccine, it's still in the case that these are weakened flu cells that your body can recognize. It gets sort of a snapshot, a profile of this type of flu virus, and then it can be on the alert? Is that
exactly. They're killed pieces of several viruses that we think will be around this season. And it's sort of, you know, if you can imagine preparing for a soccer match or a piano recital, you don't just go into the big game or the final, you know, right, the final recital. You give yourself time to practice. And that's exactly what this is. You're giving your immune system time to practice and to learn what to look for.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the flu strains in this year's vaccines.
Yeah, so the flu vaccine is always going to include strains that are going to fight against both influenza A and influenza B. Now, within influenza A, you'll probably hear people refer to things like H1N1 or H3N2. Those are two of the strains that are covered this year and are covered many years. Those H's and N's actually refer to hemagglutinin and neuraminidase, and those are just proteins that sit on the outside of the virus. And as you mentioned, those are sort of the pieces that we're looking to teach your immune system how to defend against. So you'll get some influenza A, and you'll also get some influenza B. This year, in the vaccine that has three viruses, the B version will be a Victoria strain. Those are usually just named for where we recognize them. And if you get the flu vaccine that comes with four viruses, you'll get an extra B virus.
I'm reminded that 100 years ago, we had a flu pandemic that killed millions of people. This is the 100th anniversary of the first worst flu pandemic we've ever had.
That's right. So in 1918, 100 years ago, we saw the worst pandemic of all time with influenza. And interestingly, October is actually the deadliest month during that pandemic. Now, certainly, we've had a lot of advances. We have better surveillance. We have vaccines. We have a better understanding of how these things move. But flu remains a really important public health concern. And as I mentioned, if people are looking for something to do to improve their overall health and keep themselves from getting sick, getting the flu shot is really high on the list.
Mm-hmm. It was that 20 million died in 1918 and thereabouts? Something like that?
Yeah. Yep, 25.8 million people were infected, 670,000 deaths. Just an absolutely dramatic event that resulted in a decrease in life expectancy at the time.
Right, and it had something to do with also, I believe, the end of the First World War. You had all these troops returning to their home countries, returning to the U.S., so you had infected people traveling the world?
Yes, unfortunately, we think that's one of the ways that this virus was able to spread so efficiently, because, as you've mentioned, there were people traveling internationally at the time related to the war efforts. Now, these days, of course, international travel is even easier. So again, you know, we always keep a lookout for ways to monitor and do surveillance for viruses like this, because, again, you know, flu remains an important public health concern.
Okay, we want to thank you very much. Dr. Caitlin Pedati, Iowa Department of Public Health Medical Director and State Epidemiologist. How can people find out more through your website?
Yes, please visit us on our website, and we share lots of great information there. And again, I would just reiterate that local and state public health here in Iowa are always happy to be good resources for people with health concerns.
Well, you've been a great resource for us this first half hour, Dr. Pedati. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, to finish off this half hour, let's get a quick update on a huge lingering financial headache in Cedar Rapids after a community party back in August. That's when a three-day festival that featured musical acts, Kelly Clarkson, also Maroon 5. This was a $2.3 million loss in the community of Cedar Rapids. Brian Morelli is with us with the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well. We're talking, just to remind our listeners, talking about the Nubo Evolve Festival put on by Go Cedar Rapids. We have about 5 minutes. Get us up to speed quickly on the basics of this debacle. How did it unfold?
So the festival lost lots of money, as you stated. About a week ago, the board of directors announced that the organization was folding. They were ceasing to exist. Meanwhile, they owed about $800,000 to vendors, $1.5 million to a local bank.
What organization? What organization?
Go Cedar Rapids.
Go Cedar Rapids.
Mm-hmm. Is the name of the Tourism Bureau. They basically had no money left. They had run out of money. They basically were at the point where if they kept going, they couldn't pay employees, so they just folded. And these vendors basically had been told all along, you know, ever since they announced that how much the loss was, checks had been bouncing, people weren't getting their money, these vendors weren't getting their money who had helped put on this festival. And they'd been told, you're going to get your money, just bear with us, we're coming up with a plan. And they couldn't come up with a plan. The plan basically would have relied on the taxpayers to bail out the organization. The city council was not going to support that. And so these vendors, they closed. The vendors had no idea. They weren't given notice that they were closing, that they weren't going to get their money. As far as they were concerned, they were going to get paid. And so now, it's a mess. And, people like John Waters, he's one of the top acts. He's a nationally known filmmaker. He performed. He was among those who weren't paid. He kind of sounded off against about the festival and about the city itself, saying that who would have thought the city of Cedar Rapids would have ripped me off? I'm not going back there, and I'm going to tell anyone who asked not to go there. That was something he told me. So,
who is responsible? I know jobs have been lost, but who's responsible for this?
So I guess it depends who you ask. They fired the executive director and Aaron McCrite and the development or the community events director Scott Tallman. They fired them and said. This is the board of directors fired them, saying that they were misled, they were given bad information. Had they got the right numbers, they could have scaled back the event, but they said they were misled. You know, other people are looking at the board of directors. What was their fiduciary responsibility? What kind of questions were they asking? What information did they get? And so at this point, it seems like kind of the authorities that be just want to kind of move on, want to take the next step, but there's still a lot of questions, and people are pretty upset about this.
Right.
So
Bankers Trust figures into this. How?
They extended a $2.25 million line of credit. They were still owed $1.5 million when the organization folded. They let go of their market president, who my understanding is he was the top person in Cedar Rapids, this being one of the largest, if not the largest bank in Iowa. So they are out a lot of money as well.
Mm-hmm. Who's going to eat these losses, do you think, in the end?
I mean, at this point, it looks like the vendors and the bank. The city council has said they're not going to bail them out. This was a separate, go Cedar Rapids, the Tourism Bureau. You know, even though it is an arm, the city's tourism arm, and the city gives them about $1 million a year, the city has drawn a clear line. This is a separate organization. This is their, they made these choices. We can't ask the taxpayers to bail them out. So it doesn't look like the city is going to be chipping in money. We had an article on Sunday kind of looking at what sort of legal options there might be. You know, we might see some civil suits. There's, potentially some criminal, avenues that people could look at in terms of, bad check laws, wire fraud, federal wire fraud or mail fraud charges. So it seems like there's a few options out there, legally speaking, but, who are they going to go after? Are they going to go after individual board members? Are they going to go after the guys that were fired? On their own, they might not have a whole lot of money to go after. So,
Brian, there's an editorial that ran in the Cedar Rapids Gazette today criticizing the city for putting an event this big into the hands of people not from Cedar Rapids. The piece also criticized Go Cedar Rapids for not involving more of the local community. Do you think we may see a festival like this that's framed very differently in the future? Or will this be the end of a project like this in Cedar Rapids?
Well, it's too bad because I think a lot of people did, people did have a good time who went to this festival. Obviously, they didn't get the numbers they wanted to turn out, but this has been such a black mark that I think it'll be a while before anyone tries anything like this again.
Mm-hmm. But you're saying the community would like to turn the page. Do you think the page will be turned? You mentioned a few follow-up chapters, I guess, we could see in your reporting.
I mean, I probably have like a dozen storylines that I'm kind of pursuing. So I don't think it's going to be, I think probably from an official perspective, people are ready to kind of move on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think from a reporting standpoint, I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions, and that, I think I'll be busy reporting on this for quite a while.
Right. You mentioned John Waters being very upset. He was stiffed, not paid at all. In the entertainment business and in those circles, do you think that threat has some weight that Cedar Rapids will be tarnished for a while?
One thing I do want to correct, he was paid some of the money up front. He was not, but he was not paid in full. So I think mm-hmm. something like he was supposed to get half up front, half at the back end. You have to imagine, I'm not an expert, but having someone like John Waters bashing your city can't help. And he's been in the business for a long time. He was telling me that, he's been doing this for 50 years, and this is only the third time he's ever not been paid. And the two other times were these kind of murky film festivals where it was almost like you kind of see it coming. But I think he feels particularly duped, considering this was, very official sounding event and put on by, an organization, an established organization.
Well, Brian Morelli, thank you for bringing us up to date. Reporter with the Cedar Rapids Gazette, talking about this lingering financial headache in Cedar Rapids after that three-day festival, Nubo Evolve Festival. Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we'll explore a new movement. It's called Gender Responsive Corrections. An idea that in a prison environment, rules created to control men, particularly violent ones, don't often work well for women. We'll talk to a warden and deputy warden when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Next, we want to explore a movement called Gender Responsive Corrections. And it's really a simple idea that in a prison environment, rules created to control men, especially violent men, often don't work well for women. We want to explore that with Cheryl Dahm. She's warden at the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women in Mitchellville, along with Lori Woodard, deputy warden at the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women. Cheryl and Lori, warden and deputy warden, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Introduce us to this idea, gender responsive corrections. Warden Dom, what's behind it?
What's behind gender responsive corrections and trauma informed corrections is really wrapping the women's pathways into how we walk with them in their life in prison and addressing characteristics of women. Mm-hmm. Being traumatized in their past, and that most of the women are not there for violent crimes, that it's about relationships, whether they're family or significant others or friendships or support systems. It's taking a look at a holistic approach for the women and really being strength-based instead of looking at the, for lack of a better word, the negative reasons that they come in, but really taking a look at what we can build on with the women regarding their strengths.
Mm-hmm. To give us a sense of your population of offenders there, what is the range of offenses that women are held at the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women for?
Most of the women are incarcerated for property offenses, as opposed to the men that are opposite of that. They're more violent, meaning the men. The women are property.
Mm-hmm. Theft, burglary, yeah. But also homicide as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We do have people in there from life sentences to two-year sentences.
So what is the basis? Give us an example of a common disciplinary situation. Either of you, please. Tell us how it was formally dealt with along the, let's just say, the men's model for dealing with discipline compared to how gender-responsive corrections, the female version of that, would respond to a situation. What would be an example of something that needs some discipline and there would be a stark difference in the type of discipline?
I had brought this up with NPR, and we had some staff that were concerned that the women were wearing their clothing inside out. In a male institution, that may signify a gang affiliation or something in that manner. Mm-hmm. For the women, it's not going to signify a gang affiliation. It could be as simple as maybe it was dirty on the outside. Maybe they just wanted to wear it like that. But there's a rule in prison that says that you're supposed to wear clothing as it's intended. So that is a rule that is in policy. And we began to push that a little bit, saying, is that really a rule that we want to focus on?
Are you telling me that in women's prisons there are no gangs?
No. We have people that come in that are affiliated with gangs, but here in Iowa we have very few identified STG members in our female population.
Mm-hmm. Deputy Warden Woodard, can you tell us what kind of data you've collected on these type of corrections compared to the older model?
Well, I would say overall recidivism is fairly low in Iowa in general for men and women. For women, it's about 29% right now.
Mm-hmm. And that's within, is that recidivism within the prison setting, or recidivism in terms of being having done your time and gone out and then reoffended?
Recidivism can be defined in a variety of ways. For the purpose of this, it's about 29%. That could be about 3 years out, and that could be for new offense or technical violations.
Mm-hmm. And that's once they're out of prison.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Mm-hmm.
All right. And how does this new model change behavior within the walls of the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women? How long has it been in place?
Cheryl could probably speak to that better. When we were visiting, before we knew we were coming on this radio show, the idea of gender responsivity has been around for a long time. This isn't new. I'll go back as far as my time in corrections. Since 97, there was a curriculum that was introduced to both prison and community-based corrections called Moving On, and it was the introduction of a first curriculum statewide that was written specifically for women who were justice involved. So this isn't new. However, it's a journey for us.
Mm. What do you mean by a journey?
I think the more we learn, the more we have to adapt and adjust our practices. And this isn't a new concept, but it's one that we always pay attention to. We always are looking at what does the research tell us, what direction we should be going, and taking a look at our everyday practices. Cheryl alluded to something as simple as wearing a shirt inside out and really examining our policies, our practices. Are they serving the needs of our women? Are they serving the needs of the community when the women are released? Mm-hmm. Are we doing things that will really help the women under our care return to the community healthier, productive, less likely to become reinvolved with the justice system?
And Warden Dom, that is your overall goal, to, for those who are not sentenced to life in prison, to return them, and rehabilitation is the goal.
Correct. And I think that when we as corrections make rules and not allow the women to challenge those and to process why they don't want to do it, or not to have a conversation about that, we're doing the public a disservice and them. Part of growing is to start processing that and having conversations, not being told what to do, but to give parameters and then understand as staff when we want to have conversations with people about why are you talking like that? What can we help with? Let's talk about that a little bit more, because what we want to do is build a strong woman, and that means that help her process that through and help her learn. Sometimes decision making is falling down and getting back up again and understanding, looking at all avenues.
It sounds like an approach you might be able to approach with men, some men at least, or not. I mean, I don't know if this is gender specific or more personality specific, or is it the culture of a men's prison versus a women's prison?
One thing I think we don't want to forget is women come into the system with specific personal histories that are different from most men.
Okay, how so?
I would say the vast majority of the women that are incarcerated, not just in Iowa, come into the system with histories of sexual abuse, domestic violence, sexual assault, trauma histories that are gender specific. And so it's incumbent upon us to address those, to recognize that, and to work with the women in a way that will get at the root of some of their struggles on the outside and begin a healing process.
Men come into prison in a different, their pathway with violence, because one of the things that we hear is, well, men have trauma too. It's trauma. It might be defined the same, but the pathways are different. Women are usually traumatized by those that are closest to them, by their friends, by their significant others, by those that care about them and say, I love you. At the same time, I'm abusing you. Men have trauma because they see violence. They're part of violence. It might be the group they hang out with. It's different pathways and different ways that the genders experience it. And our role at Mitchellville is to make sure that we clearly and skillfully know that we are working with females, and to understand those pathways and help navigate those. Because you're right, some of this can be applied to men. It doesn't take any work to be kind or respectful. But our job, and I would say it's our job as ICIW staff, is to be skilled in why the women have a pathway that led to us.
If you just joined us, my guests are the warden and deputy warden of the ICIW, the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women. It's located in Mitchellville, Iowa. And Cheryl Dahm is the warden. Lori Woodard is the deputy warden. We're exploring a growing movement to reconsider how women are treated in prison across the country, also here in Iowa, of course. So let's see. You referenced an NPR piece, a recent NPR piece. Let's listen to the voice of an offender, Mary Tyler. She is living at the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women in Mitchellville. She was sentenced to life in prison in 1978. She says she much prefers the new style of discipline that's being used.
I would say in the scheme of things, if I had to say one way or the other, I would so much rather have it with Cheryl and with lessening and the loosening, because it's so much better. Because, you know, the anger and the repugnance that you get from being treated unfairly or just, you know, nonsense.
Mm. So I wonder, it's okay, it's nice that the offenders find it better, but I guess the real question here is it not what is more effective?
That is a real question, and I think that's something that we continue to work with our population and with staff, with existing staff, with new staff that are hired, is discussions about what's effective, because all of us may have things in our mind about what's effective parenting techniques, what's effective discipline techniques, what works to change someone's behavior. And we know many of the men and women that are under our care in the justice system have been overpunished, and at a point that loses its impact. And one of the things that we do know and that we try to apply with the women is we shouldn't punish without intervening at the same time, meaning if there's a negative punishment, the other piece of that that we need to employ with every intervention is getting at what's the root cause of the behavior.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more about the training that your staff go through. Has this been a dramatic change for them? What sort of training do you have?
There's always been a component of training to address specific needs of women. And one of the things that we're doing now is adding to that. We had an opportunity to attend National Institute of Corrections, and one of the recent things that we've implemented is a curriculum called Safety Matters, Understanding Relationships in Women's Correctional Facilities. We've taken that opportunity, and three of our staff at ICIW have been trained to train that curriculum, and we have just started down the path of training all existing staff and have incorporated that into all new staff training.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say the Department of Corrections has recently in the last several years started the training Core Correctional Practices, and that is just a universal training. One of the pieces that we're adding in on, and keeping in mind this is fluid and that we know that we are going to fail sometimes and there's things that we need to do better, but one of the parts that we're adding into our new employee training is to really at the front end talk about gender responsive. We all in Department of Corrections, the new employee training is the same whether you're coming into a male institution or a female institution as a staff member.
Mm-hmm.
We think it's imperative for us as leaders of the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women that the gender-responsive trauma-informed skills and understanding is at the front end, not at the very tail end where we say, oh, by the way, you're working with women today.
Right.
But to start weaving those practices in. But that means that we have to start challenging our own practices, meaning our own staff challenge it in a good way. And they say, Is there another way that we can take a look at that?
I understand one of the changes you've tried to make is to consider trauma in talking to guards, your staff, about their tone of voice, the volume of their voice. How can that make a difference?
Well, I think with our staff, with our officers, and all the employees at the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women and myself, sometimes we can get a little salty and then backing off and saying, hey, you know, I was a little frustrated with you and I'm sorry that that came around that way. It's understanding that yelling can make somebody agitated depending on what their life was like. Simple words like coming into the unit when there's count time and you yell count can put somebody on the tops of their toes because you're yelling and not knowing what the next step would be. Even though they know it's count time, it still doesn't.
It triggers something.
It triggers, just like it triggers things for us out in the free world. There's things that trigger us. Mm-hmm. And we have staff that will bring that to us and say, give us ideas about how can we look at this differently.
Right. I wonder if the ideas that you have make a lot of sense, but I wonder if still get it, perhaps not making such a separation between male and female here. Do you think that maybe you are at the forefront of a larger correctional institution shift here, that one day the type of methods that you're discussing here may apply to men, that men may also find the benefit here as well?
Well, I think you're talking about a culture shift, and yes, I think that really this has to do with not only gender responsive for us, but it's changing our culture. Having your civil liberties removed and coming into prison was the punishment. And changing the culture as one of seeing the person, understanding they have victims on the outside, but seeing the person that is living with us 24/7 as somebody that we need to help rise up, and understanding that respect and kindness does not take doesn't take much. Mm-hmm. And it's a culture, that is a culture change. It's not just skill development. It is changing the correctional culture. And yeah, I would say that that is something that ICIW is looking at. We have talked about, we just talked about it today, about how do we want our culture to look? What do we want it to feel like in there?
How does Iowa compare with other states in adopting these gender-responsive corrections? You were featured in that NPR piece. Would you say Iowa and Mitchellville is at the forefront of these types of changes in this country?
Well, I think we're...
I'd like to think so.
I want to think so. I think North Dakota, after listening to their director, has us beat. However, it's not about beating. I'm going to take some of her ideas. I was just at a training for all women executives in corrections, and hearing what other states are doing inspired me and got me thinking. But I also know that we're on the forefront as well in corrections.
Yeah. Do you have an example of what you said? Ah, North Dakota, great idea. What was that?
Yeah, I think that simple things that I think that we can do at our own facilities. One of the ideas that I took away from North Dakota is when they hire new staff, they have a family training at night where they talk to the family about, your loved one might not get every vacation day off. Have them walk through the institution so they know what their business is like. Talk about EAP. Talk about the stresses of working in a 24/7 people field. Really focusing on family like we do with the women or men in our care and doing it with staff. The other culture shift, well, with North Dakota, the director talked about kindness and that you can still have rules and be kind at the same time.
It doesn't mean being less firm in your rules or being taken advantage of as staff or guards, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm. It does not.
Mm-hmm. So you're just as firm, but maybe it's just the tone of voice?
I think it's the tone of voice. I think it's our approach, and I'll circle back to at every opportunity we should be exploring and intervening in some sort to, of a way to get to the root of what drives the behavior.
That, mm-hmm.
What drives the behavior? And that's the piece I'm convinced that if we can get at that more often, that's what's going to promote behavior change in the future.
All right. Go ahead quickly.
I was going to say, no, I don't think we can think of firmer, stronger punishments and think that will be the fix.
Okay. Very enlightening. Thank you very much for sharing your insights on this interesting work on the cutting edge of correction. Cheryl Dahm is a warden at the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women in Mitchellville. Lori Woodard, the deputy warden. Thank you both for coming into our studio.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Caitlin Harrop. Help also today from Alyssa Bovinette. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.